Usually when we picture scientific progress, we tend to imagine like a lonely genius in a pristine lab.
Right, yeah, peering through a microscope.
Exactly. Having this quiet, triumphant eureka moment.
The classic narrative, a sudden flash of insight, and the whole field just smoothly moves forward.
But then you actually dive into the historical archives and you realize that progress is, well, it's often less of a light bulb and more of a bare-knuckle brawl.
Oh, absolutely. It gets messy.
So today we are opening up a highly technical, a completely ruthless academic brawl from 1987.
Which brings us to what is basically the absolute definition of a scientific clapback.
Yeah, the source material for today's deep dive is a paper titled Diffusional Formation of Ferrite in Iron and Its Alloys by HKDH Padatia.
A bit of a mouthful, but yeah.
And honestly, if you're reading between the lines, the alternate title might as well be Why Everything My Critics Just Said Is Completely Mathematically Wrong.
It really is. It's a direct point-by-point rebuttal to two prominent critics named Aronson and Reynolds, along with a few of their colleagues.
Right. And the battlefield here is metallurgy.
Specifically, we are looking at how iron and steel physically change their atomic structure as they cool down.
Okay, so they transition from a high temperature phase,
Which is called austenite.
right, austenite, and then they turn into a lower temperature phase known as ferrite.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack those terms for a second because I want to ground this in the real world for you.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So if you've ever watched like a movie where a blacksmith heats a sword in a forge until it's glowing red hot.
Right, that high temperature, easily shaped metal is the austenite.
And when it cools down and becomes the hard magnetic steel we use every day, that is ferrite.
That is exactly right. I mean, at a microscopic level, the atoms are actually rearranging their geometric grid as the temperature drops.
Now, you might be wondering why we are taking you on a deep dive into 1987 metallurgical disputes.
It sounds a bit niche at first.
It does. But you aren't just here to learn a few facts about steel. The mission today is to witness exactly how scientific progress is forged.
Pun intended.
Naturally. But seriously, it happens through these rigorous and, yes, sometimes fierce debate over these microscopic, invisible details.
And it's crucial context for you to understand because the physical world you interact with every single day depends on these exact microscopic phase transformations.
Like the steel chassis in the car you drive.
Exactly. Or the massive girders in the skyscraper you work in, the surgical tools in a hospital. When engineers manipulate how austenite turns into ferrite, they are dictating the strength, the flexibility, and the durability of that metal.
So understanding the argument in this paper is literally like reading the source code of the physical world around you.
It really is.
So let's open up that source code.
Yeah.
Hadeshi's paper comes out swinging on the very first battleground, which is the physical shape of these microscopic changes.
Right. We are talking about something called Widmann-Stettin ferrite.
Yes. So what exactly is that?
Well, Widmann-Stettin ferrite is a specific, naturally occurring structure where plates of ferrite form inside that parent austenite we talked about. And Padatia is arguing a very specific mechanic here. He says these newly formed plates don't just, grow randomly in all directions.
Right, they aren't just popping up wherever.
Exactly. They grow cooperatively in mutually accommodating pairs. And they do this for one fundamental reason, to minimize what is known as strain energy.
Okay, strain energy. Basically, when the metal transforms, it physically changes its shape,
right?
And that puts stress or strain on the surrounding atomic structure.
Precisely. To use the physics term, it's accompanied by an invariant plane strain shape change.
A big jargon heavy, but I follow.
Basically, when the atoms rearrange, they push against their neighbors. And Badesia points to direct observational evidence to prove his point about the pairs.
Right, the physical footprint.
Yeah, when these microscopic plates grow, they create a very specific physical shape. They form this tent-shaped surface relief.
A tent shape.
Exactly. This physical shape proves you have two mutually accommodating variants growing together. If you zoom out to a microscopic scale, these microscopic tent shapes essentially look like a thin wedge.
Okay, let me make sure I'm picturing this right. Is this like two people trying to pitch a large camping tent inside a tiny, crowded living room?
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Like they can't just throw the poles up violently however they want. They have to move cooperatively, angling themselves perfectly against each other to fit the tent in without knocking over the television or breaking the furniture.
Right.
By working together, they are minimizing the strain energy on the living room.
That is a remarkably accurate way to visualize it. By growing as mutually accommodating pairs, these crystallographic variants essentially cancel out some of the disruptive strain they would otherwise cause to the surrounding austenite grid.
They lean against each other so the whole room doesn't buckle.
Exactly.
But wait, I have to push back here on behalf of Aronson and Reynolds, because the paper notes that they actively questioned this whole cooperative tent-pitching idea.
They definitely did.
Didn't the critics say that the cooling rate in, like, a 3-millimeter water-quenched rod of an iron-carbon alloy completely disproves this theory?
Yeah, specifically Fe0.41C.
Right. They ran an experiment, looked at the rod, and basically said, we don't see any tents.
They did say that. And here is where Adesio delivers just an absolute masterclass in pointing out flawed methodology.
Oh, I love this part.
Aronson and Reynolds used that 3-millimeter rod quenched in water to argue against the formation mechanics. But Padescia points out a fatal flaw in their basic physics.
Which was?
Well, if you take a 3-millimeter rod of that specific alloy and plunge it into water from the red-hot austenite phase, the extreme cooling rate means you don't get Widman-Stettin ferrite at all.
Wait, really?
Yeah, you get a specimen that is fully martensitic.
Okay, hold on. What does martensitic mean in this context?
Think of it this way. When you cool the metal slowly, the atoms have time to do that cooperative dance. They pitch the tent.
Right.
But if you quench it in water incredibly fast, the atoms literally freeze in panic. They don't have time to carefully arrange into ferrite plates.
They just panic freeze.
Exactly. They just snap into a brutal, highly stressed, extremely brittle atomic structure called martensite. It is a completely different atomic beast.
Oh, wow. So the rapid cooling just violently bypasses the phase they are actually trying to study?
Exactly. The cooling rate they used is entirely inadequate for studying the formation of Widman-Stettin ferrite.
That's hilarious.
Using a fully martensitic rod to disprove a theory about Widman-Stettin ferrite is fundamentally absurd. It is like trying to study the delicate formation of ice crystals by staring at a pot of boiling water and claiming your theory is right because you don't see any snowflakes.
That is completely brutal. He's basically saying, you're looking at the wrong state of matter, guys.
Pretty much.
Okay, so if the physical shape, the cooperative tent, the thin wedge is settled, that leads to a really obvious next question.
How the boundary actually moves.
Right. How do the actual walls of the tent go up?
Yeah.
How does the boundary between the red-hot austenite and the cooling ferrite actually move across the metal?
And that question takes us right to the structure of the interface itself. The interface is the front line. It is the exact microscopic boundary where the austenite is actively becoming ferrite.
Okay.
Aronson and Reynolds argued that the movement of this boundary could be completely mathematically described just by the motion of something called anti-coherency dislocations.
Okay, anti-coherency dislocations. That sounds like a mouthful. What are we actually talking about?
In the simplest terms, they are defects in the crystal grid. When two different atomic patterns meet, they don't line up perfectly. There's a mismatch.
Makes sense.
Aronson and Reynolds thought you could just slide these defects along the border to fix the mismatch, and boom, the boundary moves.
But Boudicca steps in and says, not quite.
He corrects the record, yeah.
Yeah.
He states that normal interface motion definitely requires the thermally activated climb of those misfit dislocations, sure.
Right.
But it also requires something else entirely, reconstructive diffusion.
Reconstructive diffusion, which
yeah.
is
a critical, absolutely vital addition. The anti-coherency dislocations only accomplish the part of the motion that conserves the lattice shape. But for these types of transformations, the motion must be accompanied by reconstructive diffusion to accomplish the actual change of the atomic lattice.
Okay, let me try to translate this into the real world.
Go for it.
If the interface boundary is a zipper connecting two totally different fabrics together, say, denim and silk.
Nice analogy.
Aronson and Reynolds seem to think the zipper just magically slides down and the fabrics join perfectly just by shifting the defects.
Right.
But Padescia is saying no. Because the fabrics have totally different atomic weaves, you can't just slide the zipper. You actually have to actively unweave the silk and reweave it into denim. That's the reconstructive diffusion as you go.
You've hit on the exact thermodynamic reality of the situation there. And remember why you, as the listener, should care about this.
Right, this isn't just theory.
No, this isn't just a minor academic quibble about a zipper. It's a structural imperative for how steel hardens. Padescia explicitly states that reconstructive diffusion is a necessity.
Because if it doesn't happen.
Because without it, the movement of the interface causes massive mechanical deformation. If you don't unweave and reweave the threads at the atomic level, the physical bunching of the fabric makes the entire reaction thermodynamically impossible under many circumstances.
The zipper literally gets stuck. The physics won't allow the cooling process to move forward.
Precisely. And the consequence of that stuck zipper leads us to a fascinating debate over how the interface actually moves.
Like, does it move smoothly or what?
Exactly. Does it move continuously, like sliding down a ramp, or does it move in discrete chunks? Paneshia brings in mathematical backup here, referencing the work of a researcher named Inomoto.
Okay, what did Inomoto do?
Inomoto used something called a finite difference method to rigorously model how these ledges interact on the microscopic interfaces.
And what did the math reveal?
Inomoto proved that during the very early stages of growth, when diffusion is controlling the speed moving in steps, literally like walking down a microscopic staircase, actually leads to a higher overall rate of reaction than continuous smooth motion.
So it's faster to take the stairs.
Yes, especially when the horizontal spacing between the steps is similar to, or less than, the vertical height of the step itself.
So early on, taking the atomic stairs is physically faster than sliding down a smooth ramp. And the speed of the zipper moving in steps is exactly what dictates how quickly the steel cools and hardens.
Exactly.
Which makes me wonder, if Inomoto's math proves that taking the stairs is the fastest, most efficient way for this interface to move, why did the critics publish a whole separate set of data claiming these pleats were growing incredibly slowly?
And that contradiction brings us right to the debate over the diffusion-controlled growth of plates.
The next battlefield.
The critics, in this case, a group led by a researcher named Simonen, published experimental data claiming that the ferrite plates grew considerably slower than the mathematical models for carbon diffusion predicted they should.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because Paneshia doesn't just politely disagree with their conclusion. He calls out the foundation of their entire experiment.
Oh, he goes right for the throat.
He basically says, your plates aren't growing slower than the math predicts. Yeah. You're just using bad math to make the prediction.
It is a devastating critique of their methodology. He points out two massive, glaring errors in Simonen's work.
What were they?
First, they used an incorrect extrapolation of a specific phase boundary on their charts. Second, they used a completely empirical, basically generalized representation of how carbon diffuses in austenite.
So to find their way to the answer, they guessed the map, and then they guessed the speed limit.
That's perfectly stated, exactly. And Hedishian notes that both of these flawed inputs easily, mathematically explain the gross deviation between their experiments and the established theory, particularly at lower temperatures.
So it wasn't an anomaly in how the metal was behaving?
Not at all. It was an anomaly in their calculation.
Oh, and then the paper zooms in even further, right? Moving to the literal tip of the spear, the very edge of the growing ferrite plate.
Yes. Looking at the interface energy right at the tip of a plate.
What was the issue there?
Well, through experiments, this energy was observed to be surprisingly low, around 0.2 joules per square meter.
Okay.
The critics couldn't figure out why it was so low, so they tried to explain it away by inventing a theory. They guessed that there must be closely spaced growth ledges packed in right at the tip of the plate.
Wait, I have to challenge this conceptually because that feels like a massive cheat code.
It really does.
If they couldn't figure out why the energy was so low, why did they assume there were invisible ledges packed in there doing the work? It's like saying my car gets impossible gas mileage because it secretly has tiny invisible sails catching the wind.
It is exactly like a cheat code, and Paneshia calls them on it. Because if you actually think about the physics, Paneshia points out that if you pack a bunch of ledges tightly together, you don't magically lower the energy.
You'd crowd the atoms.
Yes, you crowd the atoms. You create immense atomic chaos, which actually spikes the interface energy.
Right. Their invisible sails would have ripped the car apart, thermodynamically speaking.
Exactly. You cannot arbitrarily increase ledge density without ruining the energy balance.
So how does Paneshia explain the genuinely low energy at the tip, if not with invisible ledges?
He points right back to his original premise. He argues that Widman-Stettin ferrite grows by a displacive transformation mechanism.
The tent pitchers.
Right. That cooperative, mutually accommodating growth we discussed earlier, the two guys pitching the tent, that naturally explains the low interface energy with the parent austenite.
You don't need to invent closely spaced ledges.
No, the fundamental physics of the displacive transformation already accounts for it beautifully.
It's the principle of Occam's razor, but for metallurgy. Don't invent complicated, invisible ledges when the basic mechanics already solve the equation.
Exactly.
And this logically forces us to look at how these changes are born in the first place, the nucleation stage.
Right, the very beginning of the transformation. The critics had advanced thermodynamic arguments, claiming that these microscopic nuclei forming by the homogeneous deformation of a small region were highly unlikely.
But Badesia calls their assumptions about stored energy completely speculative, right?
Yes. He points out they are relying on data obtained after the plates have already grown to try and explain how they were born.
Which makes no sense. He even brings in an example using a totally different metal, brass, to prove his point about the physical mechanics of birth.
Yeah, the experiments on brass are a brilliant inclusion. Researchers found that when rods nucleated near the free surfaces of the brass, they formed with a very specific, non-random crystallography.
How so?
Their invariant lines lay perfectly parallel to the surface plane.
So they naturally align themselves with the surface to minimize stress?
Yeah.
Like choosing to park a car parallel to the curb instead of ramming it perpendicular into traffic.
Exactly. This physical alignment is a smoking gun. It proves that the nucleation process is absolutely dominated by the atoms actively seeking the path of least resistance to minimize strain energy from the moment they are born.
Wow.
And Padesia also takes a semantic shot at the critics here, chastising them for their persistent misuse of the word shear.
Which is a crucial distinction in physics, right?
Oh, absolutely. The critics kept using shear to describe the nucleation stage. But Padesia points out that a homogeneous deformation, even though it implies a coordinated sweeping movement of atoms, is not always a true shear deformation.
So using the wrong vocabulary means you are fundamentally visualizing the wrong atomic movement.
Right. And if you get the birth mechanics and the basic vocabulary wrong, your more complex experiments down the line are doomed to fail. Which brings us to the growth of ferrite allotriomorphs.
Okay, allotriomorphs. We've talked about thin plates and wedges. What is an allotriomorph?
It's just another shape that ferrite can take during these transformations. Instead of neat plates, think of them as more irregular, blocky, crystal shapes that form along the grain boundaries of the austenite.
Okay, blocky shapes.
And the debate over how fast these blocky shapes grow is where Padesia really dismantles the critics' experimental techniques.
He goes specifically after their use of a high-tech machine, right? The thermionic electron emission microscope, or THEEM.
Yeah, the THEEM. The critics relied heavily on THEEM experiments to assess the growth kinetics of these allotriomorphs. But Padesia states flatly that the stereological errors are massive.
Stereological errors. What's stereology?
Stereology is essentially the science of translating 2D microscope images into 3D structural data.
Uh-huh.
Padesia argues their translation was so flawed that the resulting data is completely unusable for assessing things like faceting on growth kinetics.
So it's like trying to accurately guess the architectural blueprints of a building purely by looking at its shadow at noon.
That is a perfect way to describe it.
But the real aha moment for me was when Padesia looked at their actual plotted graphs for rich alloys.
Yeah.
Like an iron alloy containing 3.08% manganese and 0.12% carbon.
Oh, yeah. This part is wild.
He noticed that their data intercepts were hitting incredibly close to zero. And he basically says, I know exactly why your data is flatlining.
Yes, the near zero intercepts. Padesia points out that this is strong evidence of a critical physical failure in their laboratory process. It proves their experimental technique was highly susceptible to surface degradation, specifically a process called decarburization.
Let me translate this because it is absolutely wild. Decarburization means they literally baked the carbon out of the surface of their own samples during the heating of the experiment.
They ruined their own samples.
Because carbon is the primary fuel that dictates the growth rate. If you bake it out of the surface, your microscope is just staring at a totally dead static layer.
Exactly.
That's why their math hit a flat zero. They thought they were measuring a dynamic living phase transformation, but they were actually measuring a corpse.
It is a profound experimental error. You destroyed the sample while testing it, and an error like that naturally cascades into how they attempt to theoretically model the data.
Right, the models clash.
Yeah, there was a huge clash over two different theoretical models used to calculate local equilibrium at the interface, the Hilliard model and the Kirkcaldy-Coates model.
Aronson and a researcher named Bradley used these models, but Padesia points out they completely misunderstood the math behind them.
Completely. Padesia clarifies that for these types of alloy steels, there is virtually no mathematical difference between the models. They both deal with partitioning and negligible partitioning local equilibrium.
But Bradley and Aronson presented calculations that were simply objectively wrong.
Yes. And the most incredible part is that the proof is sitting right there in their own published graphs. Padeshia calls out their figure 1B specifically.
Figure 1B is the nail in the coffin.
It really is. Because they used incorrect tie lines to define the interface compositions, their own graph inadvertently showed the uphill diffusion of something called substitutional solute in the ferrite.
Okay, let's break down uphill diffusion of a substitutional solute. A substitutional solute is basically when one type of atom swaps places with another in the crystal grid, right?
Correct.
And normally, atoms naturally diffuse from highly crowded areas to less crowded areas. But uphill diffusion means their incorrect math accidentally required these atoms to move into an area that was already heavily crowded with them.
Which doesn't happen naturally.
That's basically claiming you stood there and watched water naturally flow up a waterfall. It defies the basic laws of thermodynamics without a massive external force.
It's physically absurd, and it leads to the ultimate physics violation in the entire paper.
Which was?
The critics, leaning on a concept called Kahn's theory of solute drag during grain growth, claimed there was a solute drag-like effect happening at the boundary.
But Hadashia pulls out the most fundamental rules of metallurgy to shut this down.
He points out that Kahn's theory demands that mass has to be conserved. Therefore, for a moving interface, the solute atoms cannot just be magically confined to the interface forever.
So they can't just hang out there.
No. The solute drag-like effect that the critics proposed implies a permanent, continuous alteration of phase compositions at the interface as it moves.
Which directly violates the lever rule.
Exactly. The lever rule is a foundational rule of mass conservation in phase diagrams. You cannot magically create or lose mass during a phase transformation.
Right.
If your theoretical model requires atoms to just vanish from the universe in order to make your math work, your model is wrong. You can't balance your checkbook by pretending $100 just ceased to exist.
You really can't. Okay, let's pull all of this together. This deep dive into a 1987 academic paper wasn't just like a niche look at how austenite cools into ferrite to make a steel beam.
No, it was much bigger than that.
It was an absolute masterclass in scientific rigor. It showed us that theoretical models on a whiteboard have to respect the harsh, unyielding physical reality of the atomic world.
Whether it is the macro tent shape of crystals cooperatively accommodating each other, or the absolute, unbreakable law of the conservation of mass.
Exactly.
If there is an overarching theme to Padeshia's rebuttal, it's his insistence that a lattice or a strain isn't just a notional concept. It isn't just a squiggly line on a chalkboard that you can conveniently erase if it inconveniences your theory.
Right, it's real physical stuff.
A real strain implies a real atomic correspondence. It implies actual physical atoms pushing against actual physical atoms. You have to respect the atom.
You can't fake the physics no matter how complex your math is.
Definitely not.
And I think it leaves you with a pretty provocative thought to chew on. If our understanding of something as old and as fundamental to human civilization as iron forming into steel was still generating this level of fierce, combative mathematical debate in 1987,
what's happening now?
Exactly. What fundamental material sitting inside the microchips of the device you're listening to right now are currently the subject of a bitter, unsolved academic rivalry.
The muddy waters of discovery are everywhere, often hidden right in plain sight.
And sometimes, progress requires someone to step into that mud, roll up their sleeves, and point out exactly where the math went wrong.